I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Hope you had a wonderful 4th of July yesterday. This hour, is there a new Tea Party in America? Is the anti-Trump resistance the new Tea Party? Are Republicans facing a backlash similar to what Democrats faced from the Tea Party in 2009 and 2010? And why did that backlash happen? Are there people running for office who hadn't even thought about doing so? Is this the time for people outside the political establishment to run and win? We have a really good lineup of guests for you, and I think it should be a great hour of conversation. Molly Ball will be joining us at the top of the hour. Molly is a politics writer for The Atlantic. Later in the hour, Jesse Ferguson, a Democratic political consultant who is the deputy national press secretary and senior spokesperson for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. And Robert Trzynski will also join us. He's the editor of Real Clear Future and a senior writer at The Federalist. We'll be welcoming your phone calls, as we always do, during the course of the next hour. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We're on Facebook, and that's The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Hour two of our program today, 50 years of Summerfest. It's still going on the shores of Lake Michigan here in Milwaukee, and we'll talk about how it got started and how it became a very large festival and reminisce about some of the performers who have graced the stages of Summerfest over the many years, and maybe some of you were at the first Summerfest. We'd love to hear from you, or the second, or third, or fourth, or fifth, or actually any of them. So that's our lineup for today, a program you are always welcome to join, and we're just trying to make contact with Molly. Molly's been with us many times before. She has a very interesting piece in The Atlantic. I'll tell you a little bit about it while we're trying to connect here. Is the Trump resistance the new Tea Party? This isn't a new piece. It was a little while ago, but it's still quite pertinent. 8 years ago, she writes, a new president took office who scared the living daylights out of thousands of people who'd never been politically active before. Does all of that sound familiar? She writes about there being a new movement today, the resistance that has arisen, a visceral reaction to Donald Trump's election. Thousands of people have been taking to the streets, and she says, for those who remember the Tea Party, it feels like deja vu. The parallels are striking. There's a massive grassroots movement, and there is no telling where that resistance will lead. Looking back at the Tea Party, she says, may give us a clue as to what lies ahead. Both president and his opponents burned hot, and a few years they burned out without leaving much in the way of lasting institutions, but not before they reordered Washington and changed the DNA of the political party in its sights. So that's some of what Molly has written. We should put a link to her article on our Facebook page, which we'll do later, and welcome your thoughts about all of this. Plus, there have been some very interesting people who have sprung up all around the country who really never thought in their lifetimes about entering politics. A 26-year-old political novice, New York Magazine, wrote about her, a biracial daughter of a single mom living on a base at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina with her husband. She decided to run in South Carolina for District 5. She didn't win that in the primary, but she has been bitten by the politics bug and is concerned about the number of women. I wonder how many more women will be running in the midterm elections. We can certainly talk about that. And there are other people, of course, who have decided to run. He's been receiving a lot of attention, mostly because of the ad that announced that he was going to be running, the iron worker in Racine, who is taking on Paul Ryan. We'll talk about him and some doctors who have decided that they're going to run. People who have really never thought of being in politics before are running. Is this something that you see more of happening as the midterms get a little bit closer? We're going to get Molly on a phone line because our other studio line isn't working, so we'll talk to her by phone and get that set up in just a moment. But we're interested in your thoughts about all of this. Maybe you were part of the Tea Party. You still consider yourself to be that, or you're part of the resistance. We're in times that are pretty unpredictable, so we'll talk about all of that. And I think we have Molly on the phone line now. Hi, Molly.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. How are you? Happy 4th of July, a little bit late.
Yes, happy 4th to you, too.
Thank you. Well, what a time this is in American politics. This resistance movement, you say there are things that we can learn, Molly, from the Tea Party. What's deja vu about this?
Well, a lot of things. I covered the Tea Party from its inception starting in 2009. And, you know, obviously a Democratic president had just been elected and a healthcare bill was in the works. And there were a lot of people who were motivated to enter politics who'd never been a part of it before. I think one thing that we've seen about the resistance that was also the case with the Tea Party was that it was an authentic grassroots movement, even though I always hear from liberals who say, no, the Tea Party was just astroturfed by the Koch brothers. Mm-hmm. And these days a lot of Republicans want to believe that the so-called resistance is also just the creation of, you know, George Soros and liberal organizations. In both cases, I've met so many individuals who will give personal testimonies about how their activism came from them. They were motivated by what they saw going on in Washington. You know, I met people in the Tea Party who had even been Democrats previously or not voted at all, and who were galvanized in 2009, 2010. And now I'm meeting people who say that they were not politically active before. Most of them were Democrats when they voted, but some of them say that they were previously Republicans or they grew up Republican. I was in Georgia a couple of weeks ago covering the special election that the Democratic candidate John Ossoff lost, and meeting with a lot of these volunteers, an immense amount of volunteers for this campaign. A single congressional district campaign had over 10,000 local volunteers, an outpouring of support. Now, obviously, that's not enough people to win an election. He needed more votes than he got. Mm-hmm. But the amount of energy is really stunning. And so many of these were, this is a suburban district, high education, high income. A lot of these are sort of stereotypical soccer mom types who had joined their local Indivisible movement, joined a secret liberal moms Facebook group or something like that. And were finding people to talk to in their neighborhoods that they could relate to, because they're having feelings about politics that they felt alone with, and discovering that there are more people like them.
Hmm. That race was fascinating. I was just appalled, though, Molly, by the amount of money that went into it. And maybe at the expense of another race, I believe it was in South Carolina, where the candidate lost to a Democrat by only 3 points. Were the Democrats picking the wrong race here? Were they making mistakes that doesn't bode well for them for the midterms?
I don't have an opinion on that question, but there certainly has been a lot of dissection of it. What the Democrats will tell you is that the South Carolina race was more of a long shot, and had there been that much energy, that much focus, that much money put into it, it likely would not have been as close as it was. That the attention on the Georgia race sort of backfired because it ended up energizing so many voters on both sides who might not otherwise have voted in a special election. So the South Carolina candidate in a much more Republican district than the Georgia district is thought to have come close, in part because it was a sort of sleeper race. He did have enough money to run ads, and they were ads that pitched him as a sort of nonpartisan-ish candidate. But had there been $60 million on both sides of that race, there would have been a lot more ads against him and a lot more people realizing that he was the Democratic candidate and coming out to vote against, the national Democratic agenda and Nancy Pelosi and that kind of thing.
Mm. Let's go back to 2008, which seems so long ago now. You wrote in a fairly recent piece in The Atlantic that, and this is hard to remember this, but it was true. Obama, you write, and the Democrats won the 2008 election so convincingly, many were convinced the Republican Party was pretty much over. Well, that wasn't the case. What happened?
Right. I think there is a natural tendency in politics to only see the present moment. And there were so many articles written after 2008 about the permanent Democratic majority. And even after 2010, And 2012 and 2014, you had Democrats believing that they did, at least in presidential campaigns, have whatever you want to call it, a blue wall, an unbeatable advantage in states like, say, Wisconsin, which is a great example, right, mm-hmm. of a state that never belonged to the Democrats per se. It belonged to Barack Obama. And without Obama on the top of the ticket, the Democrats could not win a gubernatorial election or a recall election or a Senate election in the state. And so that was a state that was vulnerable to being flipped in a presidential election with a Democratic candidate who wasn't Barack Obama. But it's always so tempting for whatever party has just won to look at the people voting for them and assume that they own them forever. And so, you know, the Democrats are historically powerless, despite having gotten the most votes in the last election. You do have so little Democratic power in both houses of Congress, in state houses, in state legislatures, in state positions all across the country, never mind the presidency, that you do hear the same kind of talk about how in the wilderness the party is. But it's worth remembering that comebacks can be very sudden in politics.
Mm-hmm. So what do you make of the resistance movement? There have been, as we know, massive demonstrations, not as many recently, but scientists and the Women's March on Washington was huge. There are Impeach the President demonstrations gathering huge crowds in Los Angeles. Can we determine how strong a resistance is by seeing how many people are marching?
Well, yes and no. I do think that in politics there is no substitute for enthusiasm, and to have a hardcore of devoted activists, you can produce real outcomes that way. And I learned that very much from the Tea Party, where because you had this extremely involved hardcore of activists who were putting in so much effort, they made a lot of things happen that didn't seem politically possible, particularly in Republican primaries, where they started taking out incumbents who thought that they, you know, owned that particular Senate seat forever. On the other hand, it's necessary but not sufficient to have that enthusiasm and to have that activism, because you can have hundreds of thousands of activists, and you still need more votes than that. You need the sort of silent majority of voters also on your side. You know, we just ran a piece on theatlantic.com by two of the Democrats who helped the Democrats take back the House the last time in 2006, Bruce Reed and Rahm Emanuel. And their three-step plan for the Democrats is, they said, this time, if Democrats are going to take back the House in 2018, they need a strategy, an argument, and a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's great to have this seeming backlash against the president, or at least a very unpopular president. But their claim is, without those three things, and I would probably add money to that,
right,
it's not enough just to say. And I think we saw this in Georgia too. There was a sense from these women who'd become activists that if they felt this way, their neighbors surely must feel the same way. That wasn't the case, and they were sort of caught in a self-reinforcing feedback loop where the only people they saw were the people who felt the same way they did.
Mm-hmm.
And they hadn't actually managed to convince the rest of the electorate.
So does that mean, because Bernie took off in a way that nobody imagined in the presidential race, does that mean a populist message which resonated with millennials? What kind of message?
I don't think we know that either, and that's a very interesting debate that I'm covering within the Democratic Party now. You did have the John Ossoff, the Democrat in Georgia, run on a very centrist, almost nonpartisan platform, not run an anti-Trump campaign. In fact, after the primary, I think he didn't run any ads that cast a vote for him as a vote against the president. The idea being that because this was a Republican-leaning district, that wasn't going to work. Other Democrats saying, no, we have to make this a referendum on Trump. Others saying we have to have our own agenda, whether that is, as you say, a more populist agenda or a more centrist agenda. I think the essay I was just referencing by Bruce Reed and Rahm Emanuel, their contention is you need different candidates for different districts, and that you may have some districts in which you know, a strongly liberal candidate will be rewarded, other districts where you do need someone more middle of the road, and so you can't run cookie cutter campaigns. You can't be one size fits all. Everybody's got to have their own message. I think that's arguable, frankly. I think that national elections end up being national, and even though there are going to be some people who are paying a lot of attention to their particular representative and the particular opponent of that representative, there's an element of national sentiment as well, particularly if you're talking about a wave election.
Mm-hmm. So, what happened to all of those Tea Party people who were elected to office? Have they been reelected, Molly, or have they not?
Yes, for the most part, they have. I think what we saw with the Tea Party was the activist movement became a sort of branch, a quasi-official branch of the party. The Tea Party, to the extent that it was organized, and of course it wasn't very centralized, wasn't very organized. There were always organizations that sought to speak for it or just to make money off of it, but there was never an official organization that was the Tea Party, right? It was a bunch of different groups and a bunch of different leaders and a bunch of different organs. But to the extent that it was organized, the Tea Party made a decision that it was going to operate through party politics. It was going to seek to influence the Republican Party in particular. It wasn't going to try to be a third-party movement or to disrupt the two-party system. That was, to them, a position of realism because they saw that the two parties were too entrenched to take on. I do think we see something similar happening with the current resistance, where they are working primarily through the Democratic Party. And so if what happened with the Tea Party is a guide, they get not co-opted necessarily, but they end up leaving their stamp on that party. Mm-hmm. So you saw a whole really generation of Republican politicians who had to go and pay respects to their local Tea Party organizations, to take the positions that the Tea Party wanted them to take, and also a lot of candidate recruitment. Whether they were going up against incumbents or just new candidates for office, they were inspired by the Tea Party movement. So you do have, I think, you know, there was a Tea Party caucus. Now there's a Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives. Almost all of them come from extremely Republican districts, and it's hard to get to the right of them. So they're pretty safe in both their primaries and their general elections. Although Trump has scrambled the equation a little bit. I think that's the effect that the Tea Party ended up having, was changing the tone and the perspective of the entire Republican Party.
I'm interested. I read this statistic, and it always knocks me out. Women make up just under 20% of Congress, less than 25% of all state legislatures. Only 6 of our nation's governors are women. I mentioned at the top of the show that there were some women, a 26-year-old political novice who is running in South Carolina. There's a woman running for Congress in Massachusetts who's the head of a gaming company. I'm wondering if you're going to see, considering the nature of the presidency and some of the concerns that some women have had about this administration, are you going to see more women? Have you seen more women announce that they're running for Congress?
Yes, that is definitely a big trend that we've seen. I mean, we have seen women largely powering the resistance movement so far, the Women's March obviously being the biggest gathering to date nationally of anti-Trump activists. And Emily's List reports that they've had thousands of women contact them
seeking
to be candidates for some kind of office, compared to in a normal cycle they'd get hundreds. So this is what I hear from people who work with left-of-center organizations or with the official Democratic Party organs or with groups like Emily's List and the Latino Victory Fund, who work with candidates for office on the left. All of them are saying people are just coming out of the woodwork to run for office, that they really want to channel this passion into electoral politics, and a great, great number of those are women.
Some other candidates, and maybe you know of more around the country, there's been, maybe because the ad received so much attention, there's a union worker who's running against Paul Ryan, who's run a very effective ad. This is an area that Donald Trump won by 11 points, and Paul Ryan has won it by a large number. Do you think Ryan is vulnerable, and do you think that kind of candidate, a union guy, an iron worker, that those kinds of candidates may fit the times?
Well, you know, that ad did get a lot of national attention, and I think the reason that it was praised by a lot of national strategists and political observers was because it did seem to fit that district. It did seem to be very much, at least, you know, we East Coasters, our stereotype of Janesville and the sort of people who national Democrats would hope could be rallied against someone like Paul Ryan. But as you said, you know, not only is that a Republican district on its face, it is a very Ryan-friendly district. The voters there have reelected Ryan by resounding margins and are very familiar with him. He's obviously someone who has a very high national profile and someone who has a reputation for being good at maintaining his relations with his district despite all of the national responsibilities that he now has. He had a primary in 2016 that got a lot of hype on the right, and they wanted to show they could take out the establishment. And Trump, although he endorsed Ryan, seemed to do so very grudgingly. And that primary challenger, if I recall correctly, got barely 20% of the vote. So, and that was attributed to Ryan being, you know, popular with Republicans in his district. And I think that extends more broadly to just sort of regular voters in that district. So if Paul Ryan is vulnerable, there are a whole lot of Republicans across the map who are going to be vulnerable next year.
Well, it's also one of those areas, and there are many in the country. You know, it's a working class area, very hard hit. I don't know if you've read Janesville, but it really describes what's going on in so many communities in the country that you would think that if Donald Trump's message, which was a populist message, was resonating and he knew how to reach those voters, that maybe the Democrats have learned something from that, running somebody who, you know, can identify also with a lot of the people who are working class people in the Janesville and beyond area whose lives have been really hard the last few years. And maybe, you know, they want somebody who understands their pain. Maybe they're disillusioned with what Donald Trump has done for them. And who knows? Maybe that's a part of a resistance. But it would be pretty dramatic for that to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is absolutely the hope of Democrats with that particular candidate, is that he can sort of symbolize the, Donald Trump called them the forgotten man, right? The, the white working class voters who were so famously galvanized by the Trump campaign. Democrats hoping that those people will feel let down by what Trump has done. We don't see that happening yet. That obviously is exactly what is crystallized, I think, in that particular candidacy.
Let's take a couple calls for you, and then we're going to introduce our other guests, and phone lines will be open for everybody. Our number is 800-486-8655. Molly Ball is our guest now, politics writer for The Atlantic, and let's go to our first caller is Ned. Hi, Ned.
Hello.
Hi, Ned. Go ahead.
Yes. I think as far as the U.S. House of Representatives is concerned in 2018 elections, you were talking about earlier in the hour, I think it's very dependent on the U.S. Supreme Court decision on redistricting for not only Wisconsin, but it will have ramifications throughout the country. And that also is dependent upon, to some extent, Anthony Kennedy and his decision of whether or not to retire. And he may not go along with the other four progressives on the court, but at least he said if he had an objective way of looking at redistricting, he might actually consider siding with the other four. And if that happens, then redistricting could happen possibly before 2018. It's going to be really tight to see whether that can happen, but that plays a major role, in my opinion, as to whether or not we have any kind of change in Washington, and if both the Senate, the House, and the presidency all remain still in the firm control of the Republican Party.
Molly.
Well, that's a very interesting point. There obviously is this Wisconsin redistricting case that the Supreme Court has agreed to take up. I don't actually know if that would be decided in time to elect to affect the 2018 elections. In other words, if when they decide that case, they would force the state to scramble to make the change immediately, and then how many states it would affect. I have a hard time seeing that all playing out within about a year, but it's certainly possible. I do think also that if Democrats are going to do nothing but count on a favorable redistricting decision, they're going to have a really hard time because they've got to do more than that. I think they've got to come up with a message that resonates to people and candidates that people can vote for. And those are obviously the efforts that we're talking about that are underway already. They think it is doable, even with the current map. And the current map was drawn largely by Republican state legislatures in the last round of redistricting. But still, there are 21 seats currently held by Republicans that Hillary Clinton won in her campaign last year. So those are seats that ought to be at least somewhat vulnerable. And then you have a few other seats that are sort of on the edge of that. They're targeting a number of Latino districts or districts with large Latino populations in California, Texas, and Florida. There's a lot of districts that look sort of like that Georgia district where you have a sort of high education population that Trump had a hard time with. And then you have a cluster of seats in the northeastern United States that are held sort of tenuously held by Republican congressmen. So those as have been described to me by Democratic operatives as the three sort of baskets of seats that they're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ned. Jim in Rice Lake, hi.
I appreciate your guest comment, but I think she's underestimating both in 2010 and 2016 what is the overwhelming political influence in this country, and that's race. And we have an electoral college system that disproportionately rewards older, whiter voters, which is why we have Donald Trump. And I think that his Make America Great Again slogan might have just well done Make America White Again, and that we cannot underestimate the effects of race in terms of the fact that we have a disproportionate amount of minorities and African Americans located in inner city states, which are electorally not rewarded in terms of the map. And I'd be interested in hearing her comments and response.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, obviously, race is the undercurrent of a lot of American politics. I think what we're talking about here is how do you deal with that as a matter of political strategy, and what are the party's chances of winning based on, you know, the sentiments of the electorate that exists? One thing that a lot of Democrats in Washington and across the country are worried about when they look at the 2016 numbers is that the minority electorate really didn't turn out in the numbers that they expected for Hillary Clinton. And without Barack Obama on the top of the ticket, it is hard for Democratic candidates to motivate a lot of those minority voters, particularly African-American voters. You know, I spoke to a lot of African-American voters who didn't feel at all inspired by the 2016 election, either to vote in favor of Hillary Clinton or to vote against Donald Trump. And I think Democrats were counting on those voters to be outraged by the racism that they perceived in Trump's candidacy, and it wasn't enough. So I think this goes back to the discussion about what is the positive message that you're offering to voters beyond just being against the president.
Yeah, you need a message. Let's continue. Molly Ball is going to stay with us. We're going to introduce two other people as this discussion carries on. Jesse Ferguson will be joining us, a Democratic political consultant who was the deputy national press secretary and senior spokesperson for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. And Robert Trzynski, the editor of Real Clear Future and a senior writer at The Federalist. They will both be with us in a moment, and we'll take more of your phone calls. We have many of them coming in at 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is The Ideas Network. Joining us now, in addition to Molly Ball, we're going to have two other guests this half hour. Robert Trzynski is the editor of Real Clear Future and a senior writer at The Federalist. He wrote a piece catching our attention, Why the Resistance Won't Be the New Tea Party. The left's attempt to create a resistance modeled on the Tea Party will have the opposite effect, making their basic electoral problems worse. Robert, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, great to have you here. So you don't see the resistance as a Democratic Tea Party. Why not?
Well, I think the thing that people don't appreciate about the Tea Party is it was taking advantage of a basic mismatch or a large-scale mismatch between congressmen and their districts. So the prior history of this is before 2010, when you had the big wave going back towards the Republicans. In 2006 and 2008, you had 2 years where a lot of Democrats got elected in relatively conservative-leaning districts. In 2006, Rahm Emanuel, who's now mayor of Chicago, but at the time was head of the Democratic National Campaign Committee, he recruited a bunch of, you know, relatively conservative candidates to run competitively in moderate or conservative districts, especially across the South. And this was something controversial within the Democratic circles because these were more conservative people. They were anti-abortion and pro-gun and more moderate on economic issues. But it allowed him to get these candidates who were very competitive in relatively center-right districts at a year when the Republican Party was weak because of the Iraq War. And now, the other thing that happened is in 2008, you had such a big wave of popularity for Barack Obama that it also carried a lot of people over the threshold. I saw that near me in Virginia's 5th District, is Charlottesville and Lynchburg, that area. It's a relatively conservative district with some, you know, the university town in Charlottesville creating enough Democrats to make it somewhat competitive. And at the best year for Democrats in many decades, Tom Perriello got elected by 800 votes, by a margin of 800 votes. So you can see that there was this sense that that's not going to last. That's the best year in a generation for Democrats. He only wins by 800 votes. That there's somebody who's potentially out of step with his district. And I think the second big ingredient, so you had, you know, a couple of dozen seats at least where you had somebody who was farther to the left in the seat than it would be normal for that district. And I think that's something we don't have today. I don't see that as being as big a factor today, especially because President Trump didn't really have a lot of coattails on the congressional level. In fact, most Republican congressmen, I think virtually all of them, were elected with a larger percentage of the popular vote in their district than Trump got. You know, he did not win with an overwhelming majority. A lot of the congressional races, the Republicans won by a larger margin with more popularity. So it's not so much that they were coasting off of his coattails to get into office. So I think you don't have that large-scale mismatch. Now, the other big ingredient in 2010 was you had something that Barack Obama was doing, a piece of legislation, Obamacare, that he was pushing through, as well as other things related to that, but Obamacare was the center, which was moving too far left too fast for a lot of people. So that sort of gave an extra impetus where you had these districts that were, the congressmen that were a little out of step with their districts, they'd run as more conservative candidates in a lot of cases, and then they go off to Washington and they vote with Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi and Barney Frank, who at the time was, you know, one of these far left guys who was in the leadership, Democratic leadership in Congress. So you had that sort of providing extra impetus for this idea, we got to get this guy out of our district because he's not in touch with us, he doesn't represent us, he's gone way too far to the left. Now I think the Democrats are trying to recreate that with sort of personal disgust at Donald Trump, which I think will have some impact, but I'm not sure that it's going to be nearly as big an impact as something very specific that Trump does that makes a lot of people angry. Mm.
All right, let me just read to you. We're going to introduce our next guest, but let me read to you the first paragraph of a piece that he recently wrote because it's interesting what's happened since 2009. Jesse Ferguson writes, on August 25th, 2009, Democratic Congressman Bart Gordon held a town hall meeting in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. A local news report called it a discussion about the nation's health care. It led to loud boos and heckling from the crowd. On February 9th, 2017, Republican Congresswoman Diane Black, elected to Gordon's seat in the fall of 2010, held a town hall meeting in the same city. A local news report headline proclaimed Diane Black, GOP lawmakers faced defenders of Obamacare at a lively town hall. Sounds similar, right?
I think there is some similarity to it, but the question is going to be, in the overall scheme of things, is that going to create the same amount of anger? Now, the Republicans haven't even passed that legislation. It isn't even a repeal legislation. It's sort of a it's being treated for PR purposes by both sides, strangely, as if it were a total repeal. It's not really a total repeal. It's tinkering. But I'm not sure that's going to have the same impact as the that a re-engineering of Obamacare is not going to have the same impact as the passage of it in the first place. So far, the other thing I'm looking at is the early indications are that in a lot of these cases, well, for example, one example I saw this, I think it was Jason Chaffetz, a Republican congressman for the Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
There were similar stories like that about people crowding into his town hall meetings and haranguing him and all that sort of thing, angry over what had been done with Obamacare. But if you looked at some of the stories, there were people who had driven all the way from California to go to his town hall meeting in, I think it's in New Mexico. These were people coming from outside the district to vent their anger at him, which is a very different thing from people inside the district. And then the other thing is, Jason Chaffetz is in a very secure Republican district. It's one that leans very far to the right. It's not like what happened with Tom Perriello in Charlottesville, where he was kind of a marginal guy on the bubble in a district that could go either way and usually goes more to the right. So that's why I mean that you have to look at, is there the large-scale mismatch between congressmen and their districts?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not seeing that nearly on the same level.
Jesse Ferguson is also with us, and Molly is also with us. We have a lot of guests right now, but let's hear from Jesse. Jesse, Democratic political consultant, who is the Deputy National Press Secretary and senior spokesperson for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. And thank you very much, Jesse, for being with us. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you on. So we started with that paragraph, which is interesting. Now we're seeing people from the left who are showing up at Republican or Democrats, not necessarily from the left, but Democrats and progressives showing up at town hall meetings for Republicans. You wrote recently that Republicans face a backlash akin to what Democrats faced from the Deep Tea Party in 2009 and 2010. How big is it, and what kind of impact may it have, do you think, on the midterms?
Again, thanks for having me. I don't think you can understate how big an impact this phenomenon can have. In the midterms, the election is mostly about energy and enthusiasm, and right now there is a tremendous energy and enthusiasm to fight back against the Trump administration. When you look at any poll of the health care bill, it is wildly unpopular. The latest numbers have a higher percentage of people thinking that Bigfoot is real than approving of this bill. But what's more worrisome for Republicans is the intensity. By almost 3-1, voters strongly oppose this bill versus strongly support it. That's a recipe for danger and potentially disaster for Republicans in the midterm. And as your other guest was just talking about, Congressman Jason Chaffetz from Utah, he's absolutely right that district is tough for Democrats to win. It is very Republican in its lean. But it's worth noting that Jason Chaffetz just decided to resign from Congress rather than continue to have to defend President Trump and the Trump administration.
Mm. Let's go to Molly Bowe.
Hi, Molly.
Well, let's see if you can hear me. I'm wondering, Molly, if I know there's very deep unhappiness about the health care bill. Very few Americans support this bill. Do the Democrats need more than an "we don't like your health care bill" message in order to win back the House? I'm sorry, Molly, it doesn't appear to be there. Well, let me ask you that then, Jesse. Because we were talking about a message, Molly was, during the first part of the program, that the Democrats need some overriding message. It has to be more than anti-Trump. Does it have to be more than "we don't like your health care plan"? Give us another one.
That is the only thing that we bank on. We're making a mistake. That alone will not reclaim the majority.
Mm-hmm.
The country is going to want Democrats to offer solutions and ideas that strengthen the economy, that lift up the middle class, that increase wages, and the country wants a check on the Trump administration. People overwhelmingly don't like what they're seeing out of Washington. And the idea that Republicans in Congress have become something between a blank check and complicit in what the administration is doing doesn't sit well with most voters. They want someone who will go in there and look out for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that dynamic is going to be what will fuel the midterms.
Let's talk
that
about
and having the right candidates to take advantage of it.
Right, right. And we'll ask about those candidates in a moment. You, Robert, have written about, well, you wrote this, Republicans will have, you've said, many opportunities to sabotage themselves, and they have just the man in the office to help them do it. What are those ways, and are you concerned about that?
Well, I do think the health care bill is a good example of how they're doing it. I think I wrote this before the health care bill had really been, they were talking about it, but they haven't really brought it forward. And the other guest just talked about how it's unpopular. And one of the things I want to warn about that is the unpopularity of the health care bill, it has to include two things. It has to include people who are unhappy with it about it because it chips away in some way at Obamacare. But then there's a whole other group, among which I would count myself, as people who are unhappy with it because it doesn't really do very much at all. So there are people who think it goes too far and the people who don't think it goes far enough. And that's one of the classic ways that Republicans sabotage themselves, is that they will do some sort of half measure that hits the worst of both worlds. It makes everybody angry. It's like my favorite example of this is when Newt Gingrich, this is back in 95, the big Republican Revolution, floated the idea of cutting off funding for public television and public radio.
Mm-hmm.
And he floated the idea and then kind of abandoned it. And it was like the worst of both worlds, where you make all the defenders of public television and public radio angry because you threatened something, but then you don't go through with it, so all of your supporters who thought that was a great idea to cut those off, they get disappointed with you too and lose all enthusiasm because you didn't deliver. And the Republicans classically do this. They'll campaign literally for 7 solid years campaigning on we're going to repeal Obamacare. And then they get in the office and, well, gee, maybe we'll just kind of tinker with it. And we can't even, we can barely get that through the House and we can't even get it moving in the Senate. And so they'll end up sort of making nobody happy. Nobody, that their base isn't happy and isn't energized and out to defend them. And their opponents are angry with them because they tried to do anything at all. So they're sort of in the middle where they're not making anybody happy. And that's, I think, their biggest way they can self-sabotage. But I think, the key, though, here is that as far as this being a larger movement, I'm not seeing that yet, because what I'm seeing is when you have individual races, like I just took a good look at the one in Georgia's 5th District, John Ossoff. We had this guy, huge enthusiasm from outside the district. He was sort of turned into a nationalized,
yes, he was,
figure. Where he was going to be the voice of, he was going to be the way people would express their dissatisfaction,
right,
with Trump. But he was a great way for people in California to just express their dissatisfaction with Trump by sending their money to his campaign. But he didn't actually win in Georgia's 5th District, because I think it's very easy for those who are on the left, who are especially those who are in the blue state areas, if you're in New York or you're in D.C., where there's this high level of personal disgust and outrage at Donald Trump, to think, wow, this is a huge national movement. It's going to sweep all before it. But at the same time, that may not actually, people in Georgia's 5th District may not share that reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the on the ground in a lot of these congressional districts, running against Donald Trump, I don't know that that's going to be a really super successful campaign, because there isn't the level of disgust there that there is, or that people might expect from the environment in which they live.
Jesse, let's talk about candidates for a moment. We spent some time with Molly talking about some unusual people who are deciding to jump in. Are the Democrats really looking at who they're going to run for office? Do they have people who can win? Maybe that candidate in the Georgia 5th wasn't the best candidate.
Look, I think there is nothing more important than putting the right candidates in races if you want to be successful. I lived at the congressional campaign committee for both 2012 and 2014, and the races we were most successful in were the ones where we had strong candidates running. So if you look right now, there's an organization called Run for Something, which is a new organization started up to help new candidates get in. They have had over 10,000 potential candidates.
That's a lot.
Contact them.
Wow.
So we are starting to see people step forward, and they are people with unique stories and unique biographies that fit their districts.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. The hour is flying by, but we want to give you a chance to join the conversation. We now have with us Jesse Ferguson, Democratic political consultant, was the Deputy National Press Secretary, senior spokesperson for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Robert Trzezinski is the editor of Real Clear Future and a senior writer at The Federalist. 800-486-8655 is our number. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to more phone calls. Tim in Heartland. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Tim.
I just wanted to comment that, you know, I the problem with Democrats in 2016 is that they kind of ran against Trump. And as much as Hillary was a policy wonk and had her own ideas, she was terrible at communicating them. So, you know, history is definitely on the side of Democrats as far as midterm elections go, but they need to change their strategy from just resisting Trump to coming up with their own ideas and their own solutions that will get people to vote for them instead of being the party of no. That didn't really work out for Republicans for 7 years. So I don't think that's the arrow that Democrats should point.
And Tim, what do you want Democrats to talk about?
Well, I mean, for me personally,
sure.
Trying to get me a raise, maybe.
Yeah, right. I'm with you.
or tax reform that doesn't favor wealthy people. Maybe tax reform that favors middle-income people, because 70% of our economy comes from consumer spending. Why not give consumers more money instead of wealthy people who don't spend their money? That's just.
Yeah, I like this message. Come up with something that'll get me a raise, Jesse. What do you think?
Absolutely. Where do we sign? Look, I think Tim's right that we have to offer a message, but I think the evidence of the last 6 years proves that these midterms are ultimately going to be a referendum on the party in power, and Republicans are in full control. So we need to offer an alternative, but it's ultimately going to be about them. We need the people who can communicate that, and that's to your previous question about the importance of quality candidates. That's why it's so critical. And the critical part of those candidates to communicate the message that Tim's talking about is that they're authentic. It doesn't matter if they're a, you know, nursing room ER attendant, or a career state senator. If they are authentic in who they are, people will buy into what they're selling.
Interesting. In about 45 seconds, Robert, is this a year for non-traditional candidates, non-politicians?
Well, I think the idea of non-politicians coming in is overbuilt a little bit, because even in the Tea Party, it wasn't just a bunch of, you know, guys, truck drivers walking off the street and running. It was like usually people with experience. What I'll say is I'll agree with Jesse on one thing. It's not just authenticity. I would say, sister, the guy I like best is Randy Bryce, the guy who's running against Paul Ryan. Uh-huh. I don't think he's going to beat Paul Ryan, but if they can find guys like that in other districts, because what Hillary Clinton didn't have was the idea of a connection with the average person. And I think the biggest damage to danger for Democrats is going with, hey, we should have run Bernie, and run a bunch of Bernie Sanders clones who are going to go over great in the college-educated, in the big cities and the college educated, in the college towns, aren't going to go over with the regular guy. They need steel workers. They need guys who can connect to the average person.
Yeah, interesting. And on that point, we have to say goodbye. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks. I can't believe we're talking about the elections again, but they're always with us, aren't they? We thank Molly Ball for being with us, a good chunk of the hour politics writer for The Atlantic, Jesse Ferguson, Democratic political consultant, senior spokesperson for Hillary Clinton's campaign, Robert Trzezinski, editor of Real Clear Future, and a senior writer at The Federalist. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for rounding up all these interesting people and for doing on-air production here in Milwaukee, and thanks to you for all of your calls. If you couldn't get on the air, go to Facebook, leave a message. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. News is coming up. Summerfest next.